For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 314, recorded on Sunday, June 28th. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from Washington, D.C. is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
So this week we're going to be talking about planned economies and specifically relating it, obviously, to the current crisis with COVID-19 and the associated economic global meltdown, but also talking about the origins of economic planning, particularly within the private sector, where the mythology tends to be that it's all just the magic of the markets and there's no planning, which is, of course, doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense. But I think it's important to talk about that, especially because a lot of that has to do with the Second Industrial Revolution, which we've been doing a lot of episodes on recently. And we will be continuing to do because of the so many obvious parallels between the early stages of that particular phase of capitalism and our current second gilded age. So, Rachel, before we jump into this topic, which we're going to be starting with an article called "The Future Will Be Planned" by socialist economist Grace Blakely, which was published on May 18th of 2020. Before we get into that, let's go back a little bit to our January episode of 2020. This was before COVID-19 stuff. You know, we were just starting to hear about that, but we were really didn't realize how big and significant this was going to be. You know, no real shutdowns on the horizon or anything. And we were mostly talking about the bushfires in Australia and the struggles of liberal democracy and market liberalism together, the two twin pillars of liberalism, so to speak, being unable to respond to any sort of huge emergencies that require central planning. So before we get into the article on the COVID-19 stuff, I guess could you talk about, sort of recap for us our thoughts from that and how that obviously relates as well to the situation we're in now as opposed to just climate change?
Right. So I think the big meat of that episode was just how market capitalism just wasn't able to react quickly or lacked the political will really to react quickly to these emergencies. So I think at the time, just the elites were off on vacation. The PM went to Hawaii for Christmas. The people on the ground just were ending up begging for help from the federal government in Australia. And the federal government just, they lacked either the political will or the ability to quickly mobilize and respond to the crisis and actually help people on the ground in any meaningful way.
What connections do you see to the situation that then subsequently unfolded with the worldwide pandemic and economic crisis?
I think we saw a really big divide between the states, and I mean that in the big political philosophical sense, that did have a more centralized government versus the states that really kind of operated under this market capitalism. So basically places like Vietnam, Cuba, and other states that actually have a more centralized government really stepped up and responded in a way that the other states, like, for example, Italy or the UK or the US, just weren't able to. I think we were just basically stuck begging for help from our federal government, and them just kind of washing our hands of the problem and not really taking responsibility or acting in a way to protect the people in any meaningful way. Versus, I believe in Vietnam, there have still been zero COVID-19 deaths. Cuba, I think, is the same way. I think there's been a very stark divide between those two types of governments.
And I think a lot of this obviously goes by degrees, right? We don't need to necessarily look to the communist states themselves here, because as we're going to be talking about over the course of this episode, the American perception has often tied the concept of economic planning to communism, but that's not necessarily really where that comes from. And many other countries that have never been communist have applied that. And in terms of it going by degrees, we also saw that even relatively, you know, marketized and politically liberal countries like Ireland and Spain stepped in pretty quickly with measures to, you know, nationalize hospitals, at least temporarily, that sort of thing. We obviously saw France, which is sort of famous for its centralized economic planning, even under its sort of liberal system. Some of that predates kind of philosophically the liberal period. You know, you go back to the dirigist models of Colbert, the economic minister under the Sun King in the 1600s and so forth. But the French government, in response to the COVID-19 situation, you know, immediately requisitioned the production of certain perfume factories to manufacture hand sanitizer and things like that. Whereas, to put it in clearer contrast, the United States, the most sort of central response there was that at some point they did a $1,200 check once, and that was it. And that was like, live on that and stay home indefinitely. And now we're just going to reopen the economy and every state gets to figure out what to do. But the U.S., there were mask shortages, there were hand sanitizer shortages, there were hospital bed shortages and that kind of thing. It basically was the most extreme example. But as I said, it was kind of varied by country by country.
I think another key factor in states with more centralized power in their response to COVID versus states with less centralized power in their response to COVID is public trust. And I think that it could be written off as sort of like the cultural moment we're in the US and the UK, but I think there's something more to it. I think it has to do with how the system is fundamentally set up. For states with more centralized power, citizens have to live sort of in concert and alongside and build their government for the public good. Whereas I think in many cases, states with less centralized government that leave more up to the market, it sort of spawns a feeling that it's us against the government, the citizen against the government. And it just becomes really hard in moments that require unity and a unified response to get that trust and that buy-in from the people when we have built a system that pits folks against their own government.
No, I think that's an excellent point and one that's sort of difficult to tease out there, because you always wonder, well, is this an insurmountable cultural factor, you know, or is this something that you can sort of negotiate with people and get public buy-in and that sort of thing? And I think that's hard to know necessarily. But Rachel, if you want to talk about the article by Grace Blakely, who's a socialist economist, a young millennial socialist economist from the United Kingdom, she argues that it's inevitable there will be some form of central planning in economies going forward. And it's really not a question in her mind of whether or not there will be planned responses to things in the future, whether it's climate change or pandemics or whatever, or just economic life in general, but rather to whose benefit and who is making those decisions.
I kind of want to start out with her hearkening back to the 2008 recession. She pointed out that the banks, the government, and the large corporate powers really worked in concert to prop up each other's interests. So the banks were too big to fail, the bankers were too big to jail, and the government slashed the interest rates so unproductive businesses were able to survive where otherwise they might have collapsed. So they were actually working together to plan how the economy was functioning over the past decade. And that's something that we really need to look at while we're planning for the future during this situation. She points out that Amazon has reported a spike in sales, meaning that workers in its warehouses are working harder than ever, often in highly unsafe conditions. Pharmaceutical companies, supermarket chains, and private health companies can also all expect to see rising profits as this crisis continues. And also, during the discussion of how to provide relief to businesses, it was enacted in a very unequal way. So bigger businesses with more access to power in the form of like lobbyists or bank support or lawyers were able to basically grab all this relief money, leaving the smaller businesses that had less power out in the cold, basically. So we can see this happening, this planning happening right now. Right now, the people don't really have a lot of power to say, hey, this is not really how we want our economy to function. We don't want to just have the biggest powers winning, taking more and more power away from the little people or the workers or the small businesses. So people really need to work together to shape a vision of how we want our economy to look. There's a pretty good passage about this. Reclaiming the world after COVID-19 will require more than emergency ad hoc measures. On the contrary, the public must become engaged in the rational planning of economic activity. Human beings must work together to determine democratically the best use of our collective resources. This is the premise of the Green New Deal. States must use their command over our collective resources to constrain polluting activities while investing in the decarbonization of our public infrastructure to absorb job losses in carbon-intensive sectors. And as the pandemic has now revealed, state planning is not nearly as utopian as the right has made it sound. So she also pointed to the arguments against the Green New Deal. It's picking the winners and losers while increasing corruption and inefficiency is kind of the argument. I think she's pointing to a way it can go, that it actually increases efficiency, decreases corruption, and isn't kind of the scare tactics that the right wing is trying to create.
Well, and she notes specifically that a lot of those problems that are leveled at centrally planned economies, command economies, and so forth, can also be found under the existing system of free market capitalism, especially in the less regulated countries, which at this point is quite a lot of them, as we've talked about before, because even in the countries that used to regulate capitalism pretty strictly, that has sort of increasingly fallen away, even if not to the extent that it has in the United States. But for example, if your concern is that the government is, you know, picking and choosing winners and losers, and that there's risk of corruption, like that is also true of the oil industry as it currently exists. So, you know, that's not really a valid argument against central planning. And again, it becomes a question less of will we do the central planning and more about who will benefit from the central planning and how will we make those decisions. And there's another passage as well. I don't know if you want to talk about that.
Sure. Our choice is not, quote, to plan or not to plan, quote, but in whose interest should we plan? The case for democratic public planning is clear. The inefficiencies, inequities, and corruption generated by state monopoly capitalism do not result from centralization in itself, but from centralization absent the centrifugal force of democratic accountability. There is a strong case to be made that, in the wake of the crisis, the resources by then under the command of the state should be allocated by the public for the public. Absent this plan to democratize the economy, this crisis, in the suffering of so many millions of people it has caused, will have been for nothing but capital itself. Yeah, I think the key here is the democratization. Like, we need to have everybody involved in discussing where we want to go from here. I think that's something we definitely didn't see in the 2008 recession. We just had the big banks basically planning it all for us, and the people didn't really get any relief in any good way. Like, we saw all the foreclosures happening at that time. There was no relief for homeowners. There wasn't really any good relief for the workers. So we just saw a bunch of corporate bailouts, but it didn't really trickle down to the people or help them.
One of the arguments that we made in January in our episode on sort of the decline of liberalism, and again, we talked both about political liberalism and market liberalism, is that there are other ways of having democratic control and a democratic voice in a system than what might be termed in sort of more negative light, bourgeois liberal democracy. We know, for example, this is very stark in the United States when you look at who participates in elections, right? Sometimes we struggle to get even half the population that's eligible to vote or even registered to vote. And in general, the people who tend to vote in much lower numbers are quite far down on the economic power spectrum and the income spectrum and that sort of thing. When we talk about wanting to have more democratic control, a lot of that probably means things like workplace democracy, strong union representation that can help make decisions about how companies are governed, things like that, and various other mechanisms that go well beyond just the concept of, you know, showing up to vote every 4 years. I think that that's sort of the gist of the argument there. And the idea is that we're going to need to have central planning. We already have aspects of planned economies, but they're just planned by a very narrow cadre of largely unelected people, especially central bank authorities and so forth, but also some, you know, just administrative bureaucracy people. And I think a lot of people would then also argue that, you know, that it's mistaken to be talking about things like, oh, crony capitalism, because, of course, as we're also arguing here, capitalism itself and market liberalism is not conducive to these kind of responses. Kelly, did you have other thoughts on the article by Blakely before we move on?
Yeah, I think I would just like drive home the point that by the time you're asking yourself, like, should I or should I not be planning this part of our society, you're already making a decision, and to some extent you're already planning if you decide not to plan. And I think in the case of coronavirus, but also in the case of the economy, there's often quite a bit of good data and information about what the outcome will be when you do or do not plan. And so that not planning is a decision that's already being made. And the not planning in and of itself is really just means that somebody else is planning who is not an elected official.
Kelly, that is a great point to emphasize, because I think that dovetails really well into what we're going to be talking about in the next section of this episode, which is about the rise of planning within the private sector and the corporate world, especially at the beginning of that process during the Second Industrial Revolution. So one thing that's not emphasized in the Blakely article, which I kept on noticing as I was reading it, is she doesn't really talk about the concept of planning within these major corporations. Like, she mentions Amazon, you know, doing a booming business during this crisis, but she doesn't talk about how a company on the scale of a company the size of Amazon has to, by definition, be conducting very significant centralized and bureaucratic planning just within its own corporation rather than the government doing it. Which is, of course, as we talked about on previous episodes, that's the case that people make for, like, why you should nationalize Amazon or something like that. The economy that we have lends itself to very large enterprises, and the question is, do you want the private sector bureaucrats making decisions and planning for your economy, or do you want government officials that have to answer to some sort of democratic process to make those decisions? But I think we need to go back to the beginning of this in the Second Industrial Revolution and talk about the twin forces that led to the creation of and development of very large corporate bureaucracies. And there are basically two things that lead to that. One is technological innovations that make that possible, and we'll talk about why it wasn't possible before the Second Industrial Revolution to have bureaucracies on the scale that we started to see at that point. And two is, of course, changes in necessity and scale and scope, right? Obviously, you can go back several hundred years before the 1870s and look at, you know, Renaissance banking operations across Europe or whatever, and that, oh, they look at all the correspondence they were sending each other and conducting business over these long scales and so forth. But there is really nothing like the scale and size of these, you know, monopoly and cartel corporations and the volumes of business that they're doing every single day than what we start to see emerging in the post-Civil War period in the United States. And of course, this was also happening in other countries, but it was most obvious probably in the United States. So there's a few different things that we need to talk about when we dive into this historical angle. So one thing is the management revolution, which created a large white-collar middle class outside of governments. So if you think about before the Second Industrial Revolution, you did have some things that we would now consider to be white-collar professions, although they weren't regarded in that way at the time, where, you know, like maintaining lots of correspondence and things like that, and various clerking functions often were related to either secular state power or things like the papacy or something, right? You'd have networks where you're writing messages and instructions back and forth all over the world. And those used to be government functions. But the rise of these very large-scale corporations and some of the technological changes that we'll be talking about led to private companies adopting these themselves and having these their own sort of bureaucratic clerkship systems. And that creates this big pool of white-collar, and that's, you know, as opposed to the blue-collar jobs down on the factory floor, the white-collar guys in the offices of these companies that were running things that were no longer government jobs. So in order to run the massive industrial conglomerates that were starting to be assembled over the course of the Second Industrial Revolution, significant numbers of managers and clerical staff were required. And managers could be all the way on the shop floor up to the level of senior offices, right? So you could have like multiple corporate vice presidents. That's not something that you would have needed a lot of in an earlier period because most companies were a lot smaller. Once you have tons and tons of these companies that are sprawling all over the United States and so forth, or even just large regions of the United States, you need to have lots of managers to manage various different aspects of the company. So one of the articles that I looked at, and all of these sources will, as usual, be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com in a PDF when the episode goes up. There was a passage from one of the articles about the management revolution that I found at Science Direct. They said The Industrial Revolution brought the growth of the factory system, enlarged markets, and new scale technologies. The factory system brought large concentrations of workers and raw materials together, posing the problems of organizing, directing, and controlling work. The Industrial Revolution was not merely technical, but had impact on values, beliefs, social customs, and societies at large. People saw hope in the emerging society for prosperity, wealth, and welfare of all through the ability of such a system to provide for all the wants and needs of the people. So pretty quickly, you know, as you start getting like the rise of, you know, canned foods and things like that, which is often associated with the Second Industrial Revolution as well, and you have consumer goods start to fall in price, people start to see these corporations as being a potential solution to previous issues of poverty and things like that. Now, obviously, we have the benefit of hindsight and seeing why that didn't necessarily work out that way. But you can see that people began to see these corporations rather than, say, the government as their potential salvation that was going to make their lives better and improve quality of life and cost of living. The management revolution within these major corporations took on various forms, but most famously, and this is the one that you've probably heard about, you know, in a history class or whatever, was what we now call Taylorism, Frederick Winslow Taylor's scientific management theory. This was popularized under that term by Louis Brandeis before he joined the Supreme Court. But Taylor is sort of a stereotypical figure within the period before going on to basically be what we would today consider to be like a management consultant. And he started at age 22 as a clerk at a steel company, right? So we talked about, I talked about just a few minutes ago, the rise of this class of corporate clerks. So he is the typical example of that. And in his position as clerk, he starts rising through the ranks and noticing that there's all sorts of things that could be done to create efficiencies within the companies. There's obviously some of the more famous and widely applied concepts that became popular in companies like the Ford Motor Company, where, you know, if you change all the light bulbs at the same time, then even though some of them might not be burned out, at least you don't have to shut down the production line when one of them does burn out because they're all getting replaced on the same cycle. And so, you never reach that point where they need to be replaced. Similarly, you would do that for various machines on the assembly line. You would replace the parts at regular intervals, because, you know, lost time is lost money. But he actually had a whole bunch of ideas that specifically applied to people. And that was less applied by companies, or he would argue misapplied by companies. So he would go around the country once he took on this sort of consulting role, and he would study your company's production line and how it functioned, you know, on the shop floor and so forth. And he would say, well, couldn't you do it slightly differently? Which is something that we still see today. That's like a big thing that tech startups will pitch themselves as, like, we're going to use AI and pupil monitoring and whatever to figure out what's the most efficient way that someone can get their job done. And then you have like Amazon saying you have to complete this task within this amount of time in the warehouse or else you get your pay docked or whatever. So one of the places is actually near where I live, the Watertown Arsenal. Today, that's a mall where you can get your driver's license renewed. But at the time, this was an actual arsenal. And he would go there, for example. This is just one example of many places that he did this around the country. And he would study your production line and say, well, if you changed this aspect of the production, or you told the workers to perform a task this very specific way, then you'll get more efficiency out of them. If they move their arm in this pattern as opposed to the way they're doing it, that's going to be more efficient. Now, in his mind, he thought that he was actually improving life for the workers, and he had this whole idea that you were going to establish these economic incentives where, like, if you get more work done per worker, then you get a pay bump. And obviously the companies weren't particularly interested in that aspect of his consulting, so mostly they were just making everyone's lives hellish. But this goes to show the level of granularity that the sort of economic planners and bureaucrats within these corporations and these outside consultants would go to. Scientific management requires a high level of managerial control over employee work practices and entails a higher ratio of managerial workers to laborers than previous management methods. Such detail-oriented management may cause friction between workers and managers. That's from the Wikipedia page for scientific management, talking about Taylor's concepts. So this is when we start to see the impact of, now that we can do this level of granular managing, I guess we're going to. So this thing becomes this self-fulfilling and reinforcing cycle that begins to take off faster and faster, because the more you do it, the more it becomes a cycle that you keep on saying, well, clearly we need to have more managers to do this stuff. And we'll circle back to how that relates to some of the recent trends in the past few decades as well. But the other thing is about the technology itself and innovations, right? So all of this is only possible because of certain technological developments. Remember that in the past, even in the printing press era, it was not something that you could quickly send out a lot of correspondence with, going to the print shop and getting typeset or whatever. That was more for mass-produced correspondence, as opposed to you still, up until almost the period that we're talking about, you still pretty much had to be handwriting stuff if you were going to send out a directive to somebody. But we see several innovations that come in at this all around this time. So in the first half of the 19th century, writing utensils and the production of paper both become cheaper and more plentiful. So for example, pencils and pens. That's initially one method that becomes much cheaper than it had been and much more plentiful. You can have mass-produced pencils once you have mass production at the factory levels going on. That kind of thing starts to happen. But also mass production of paper. The way that paper was produced changed. Previously, back in the medieval days of monks and so forth, you'd be writing on like the skins that had been turned into a sort of paper-like thing, but that's super expensive. Then you have the linen-based papers, which are very high quality. And then someone came up with finally mass-produced, incredibly cheap, totally or almost totally wood pulp-based paper. Now you suddenly have tons of volumes of paper on which to do correspondence, and your only limitation is still, by the mid-19th century, that you have to have a whole bunch of people doing handwritten stuff, and that is a real limiting factor on a lot of your correspondence. As this trend comes into place, the occupation of the clerk moves from what had been a high-status job, often, as I said, associated with governments, into this sort of managerial drone function that was almost low level in some cases, right? In some cases, clerks had no managing functions. They were purely there to support the managers and to deal with the written correspondence and paperwork. But that is how you get these huge offices full of clerks at these super corporations in the second half of the 19th century. Other critical innovations, shorthand writing. So one thing that slowed down all of the handwritten stuff was if everything needed to be written in longhand, that was not helpful. So they developed shorthand writing methods that would allow clerks to write very voluminous amounts of correspondence by hand very quickly, especially if they were taking dictation, right? That is something that becomes a support function to the managers in a company. If they can quickly dictate something and you have the clerk write it down in shorthand and then you have them go and later type it out in as we'll get into typing in a second, type it out in longhand, that speeds up your process as well and frees up people to do other things within the company. So this, shorthand wasn't invented right then, but it was updated significantly during this period. We get telegraphy, as we talked about on a previous episode, that's tied very closely to the rail industry. As they're putting down rails, they're putting down telegraph wires along it. For the first time, and time is going to be an important concept as well. For the first time, you now have the ability to communicate over significant distances at the speed of light. And along with shorthand, telegraphers are also very good at doing rapid messaging back and forth at very high rates of speed compared to longhand writing. And this is before, obviously, the telephone, although that's coming later, not that much later, but pretty soon. But telegraphy at this point, by the Second Industrial Revolution, pretty well established all over the country in parallel with these railroads. Now, all of a sudden, we have the ability to conduct business, instead of doing the Renaissance style thing where you write a letter and a couple months later it arrives on the other side of Europe or whatever. You now have the ability to communicate across huge sections of a country the size of the United States, basically instantaneously. That is also a factor in the development of these internal corporate bureaucracies, because now you have the ability to do that. And then finally, in 1865 in Europe and 1868 in the US, we have the development of the first mass production commercial typewriter. That dramatically increases the speed at which written words could be recorded and obviously makes it much, much easier to start generating huge amounts of paperwork and instructions and orders back and forth and to keep track of everything that's going on. The other thing, obviously, just to mention briefly, is the linotype machine. That, again, is more about replacing the mass-produced written word, like the printing press functions. And I would recommend people listen to the episode on print media from the Well, There's Your Problem video podcast about engineering disasters. That's up on YouTube. You can check that out. That's a great history of sort of the industrial factors and processes that led to changes in the print media industry, and especially the rise of the, yellow journalism era of newspapers, when you could mass produce a pretty significant amount of newspaper per day or even multiple times per day. And a lot of that has to do with those technological innovations. As a direct result of those changes, you now have the ability to have very large newspaper corporations with their own internal bureaucracies and huge offices and tons of employees. Another thing that gets developed in this period and is a big factor in this sort of paperwork revolution within these companies is the concept of railroad accounting. This was a major innovation in the field of accounting itself and became a corporate standard outside of the railroad industry. I found an article from 1916 on JSTOR that talks about this development. The origin of the system of accounts, which is now prescribed for all railroad companies reporting to the Interstate Commerce Commission, was a system of accounts which Thomas D. Messler introduced shortly after 1862 on the Pittsburgh, Fort Wayne, and Chicago, the Northwest system of the Pennsylvania Lines West. The theory on which this system was based is that the accounts of the railroad should be a pen picture of the results of operation for the fiscal period and of the financial condition of the company's affairs. Previous to the introduction of the Messler system on the Pennsylvania Lines West, each department or division of a railroad company had its own set of bookkeepers who evidenced transactions of that department or division. These records were combined and audited by the auditor or treasurer, who drew up the balance sheet based on summarized and audited records. The Messler system combined the bookkeeping and auditing functions in a single department, the accounting department. The Messler system accomplished four important changes. 1. The accounting officer was made responsible for the condition of all accounts due to the company and for making of settlements with other companies, so that's that accounts receivable and payable. Two, there was established the forwarded basis for the settlement of interline freight accounts and the balance of station accounts between the forwarding and receiving stations. Three, a classification of operating expenses by departments. Four, all accounts payable and journal vouchers were required to be signed by three parties. And now you really get a sense of the level of bureaucracy that was emerging in this period within companies. The clerk originating the voucher, his immediate superior, and the head of the department interested before these accounts could be journalized. And then it also mentions in this article that another manager at Pennsylvania Lines West also made a critical change in the practice in the 1890s. He standardized every single person's job title or corporate nomenclature across the entire company so that they could keep better track of what the prevailing salaries and wages were, and they knew exactly what every single person in the company was supposed to be doing and responsible for. And as rail executives and managers moved on to other rail companies, which they often did move around between these different companies, they would then bring the new accounting practices with them. And that's how it spread throughout first the rail industry and then the rest of the corporate world in the United States during this period. And that is another example of how you start centralizing everything instead of having, as they said, each little individual office of the railroad company handling its own books. You now have one centralized company-wide, operation-wide bookkeeping system that is controlling pretty significant regions. And then, of course, that leads you to have things like regional vice presidents and things like that. And then there was a study that I read in the Journal of Innovation, Economics, and Management from 2008. It was called Industrial Revolutions and the Evolution of the Firm's Organization in a Historical Perspective. More broadly, many innovations in railroad management over multiple regions were carried over to other industries. The complexity of the railway's operations required professional managers who subdivided their operations into smaller groups and then appointed middle managers to supervise and monitor the different functional activities. The movements of trains, the handling of traffic, the maintenance of motive power, equipment, and accounting. To operate these activities, railway managers devised a line and staff system. Both departments and central offices were built up. So at this point, you can see that between the need and between the technological innovations, you suddenly have this explosion in this sort of paperwork managerial revolution and this obsession with gaining and squeezing extra efficiencies out of the system through very careful management and planning and so forth. People like Taylor argued with the scientific management principle that you should have so many managers working so much that they were doing basically almost like they were planning in their minds or on paper all of the operations of the company for each day and each week and each month and each year, planning out ahead, this is what is going to be accomplished by the actual workers in this geographical area over this time period. It could be as small as your shop floor. This is how many widgets we're going to produce today. It could be as large as this is what our, you know, our economic plan is for all of, you know, 1890 or whatever across the entire country or across some region of the country. And the final thing that we need to talk about here is what is, I hope, obvious to people, but maybe some people aren't familiar with this. There is one example that ties all of these things together. It is probably, I would argue, one of the largest acts of central planning ever undertaken in world history, and it was undertaken entirely in the private sector outside of public hands. This was something that the public, the governments, the elected governments or unelected governments of various countries adopted and entered into force of law, but not until after the private corporations had worked amongst themselves to set the standard, and that is the creation of time zones. You might have heard about how time zones originate from railroad companies, but again, let's think about this in terms of the conditions that were emerging in this time period. Now, this happened in two slightly different time scales depending on where you're talking about. It happens first in the UK in the 1850s. And again, that was basically a relatively geographically contained area. It's all one time zone. And the railroad just needed to basically standardize stuff so that you didn't have the company, you know, you didn't pull into the station and have a different time of day because noon fell based on sun times at 10 minutes later or whatever. the companies in the UK, right before the Second Industrial Revolution, say, hey, we need to have standardization. They picked Greenwich Mean Time at the Greenwich Observatory as their standard time, and then they standardized that, and then all the towns basically adopted it because you had all these clocks at the stations for the trains, and so it was just easier to standardize that. But then we see the real coup that the railroad companies pull off in North America, which is that one guy suggests that all of the railroads in the United States and Canada should set up a series of time zones, because you obviously they didn't want to have one time zone for the entire country. I mean, countries like China do that, I guess, but it has various significant drawbacks if the sun is so completely shifted from what you would expect it to be. But this one guy said all of the railroads need to coordinate amongst themselves and to divide up North America into time zones, basically four time zones for the continental North America, and that they need to implement them across all the companies as one big thing. Because initially, each railroad tried to standardize similar to what the UK had done, except that you could have a situation where you would have one train pulls into a station and the people go to switch trains to a different railroad line at a union station. And it turns out that that railroad's using a different standardization of their time. And oops, you missed the train. So you can't have that happen. So, and you have now railroad companies that are straddling the areas of the time zones with their operations. So there is some need for standardization, both within companies across the country geographically and between companies. So on one day in November 1883, all of the railroad companies basically together in concert launched an official standardization of time across North America. And I think you cannot get a better example of central planning that does not come from the government than that. And which is not to say that that is better than having the government do it, is just to point out that it is very much done by very large corporations and corporate interests. And it goes back to that question that we talked about earlier, not will we have central planning, will we have planned economies, because that is already in place in certain elements. It's just a question of who is making those decisions and who is benefiting from those standardizations. So do either of you have observations about that historical context before we loop back to the modern day context?
Yeah, just to underline your last point there, which connects to the first article, is just that the private sector has spent a lot of time and a lot of resources in developing tools for planning, whether it be the shorthand you mentioned that allowed more sort of planning and management functions, or the time zones. I just think it's worth sort of underlining that the theme through all this is that private companies have every intention to plan, and have developed the tools to do so. And so now it's a matter of whether the government can step up and play a larger role in planning as well, so that they can be planning for the public rather than planning for profit.
Something that kind of jumped out at me is that Taylor actually did want to improve working conditions for the workers by introducing these efficiencies, but just the fact that the managerial and owner groups or classes really kind of twisted that for their own means and to actually wring more labor out of the workers. So I think that's something we also need to look at, is what is the end result of these, what may be well-intentioned processes. We have to make sure that the worker isn't just getting more labor, like, pulled out of them without much benefit. And yeah. I think like your example of like the piecework or the bump in pay, if you manage to like hit a certain number, I think that has definitely been really twisted and used to punish workers in the form of like quotas, or like you said with Amazon, if you aren't pulling an order, like, I think it's a ridiculously short amount of time, like 20 seconds or something like that, like, you get punished by the owners or by the managers.
Right. So the last thing that I want to say about the historical context before we pivot to our final article that we're going to talk about, because I think this is the bridge between these two things, is, again, it's not even just oh, planning exists within these large corporate, you know, cartel interests, right? And obviously, if you go back to the first Industrial Revolution, most companies were significantly smaller. They often were only one factory, or maybe it was one mine, or maybe they, you know, if you had a particularly large one, they'd own a few factories and a few mines. You get the second Industrial Revolution, the rise of these really significant and huge industry-spanning corporations, as we obviously talked about with things like Standard Oil in our mini-series on that we just wrapped up a few weeks ago. But the other thing that I'm trying to underscore here is that in tandem with the notion of this private planning that goes on is the creation of this very significant manager class and bureaucracy within these corporations. Some of the people, as we said, were not managers. They were doing white collar jobs within these industrial companies, but they were doing office functions to support the managers effectively. One of the things, again, you know, we talked about with Blakely's article, she talks about the critiques that get made of planned economies and, you know, oh, it's so inefficient and bureaucratic and corrupt and all that stuff. But you can look at, you know, these companies from the Second Industrial Revolution and see very clearly that even as far back as the 1870s, you have, once it becomes technologically possible and needed by size, you have private companies implementing their own internal private bureaucracies with huge, you know, bureaucratic functions within companies. And I think many people, especially people who have office jobs today, but also certainly actual, you know, like shop floor workers and stuff who have to then interface with the managers, or say like you work at a grocery store or something, everyone's familiar with that sense, that nagging sense of what the heck does this person do? Like it can be very opaque as to what a lot of these managers do. And so me emphasizing a lot of this, some of it I'm arguing is from necessity. Some of it is also probably not from necessity, as we're about to talk about. So people notice and often wonder like, okay, what does this manager do? Does this person have any power, or is it their boss? You know, my boss's boss that has the ultimate power? Is it the boss's boss that has the ultimate power? Who actually has decision-making authority and so forth? We see that a large bureaucratic system already exists. So again, some of that is a necessity, but some of it is probably not. But to suggest that having a planned government economy is somehow uniquely problematic because it would be bureaucratic in some way is obviously missing the point that has existed since the time of the Second Industrial Revolution, which is that also large corporations have these as well. And that brings us back to the modern era. In an article in Harvard Business Review from 2016, or at least on their website, I don't know if it was in the print version, the headline of that was, "More of us are working in big bureaucratic organizations than ever before." So this is looking at the state of the managerial class, if that's such a thing. Basically, people who neither own the means of production nor are working, producing for the company in terms of actual labor functions. They're just interfacing between the capital owners and the actual laborers within these companies. I'm drawing labor to be very broad, to the point of even if you're moving stuff around in a spreadsheet, but you're at the bottom of the totem pole, for the purposes of the article we're about to talk about, that's a laborer. If you're the person who manages the people who are moving stuff around in the spreadsheet, then you're in this other category of people. One thing the Harvard Business Review piece doesn't talk about is why the 1980s onward sees another surge in managers and corporate bureaucracy. Although I think there's a clear parallel to the technological innovations of the Second Industrial Revolution that enabled a paperwork and clerical revolution. Once offices have desktop computers networked to one another and eventually networked across the country and networked to commercial computer printers in the office, the volume of paperwork and correspondence, both physical and electronic, can explode again. The internet part of that chain of developments presumably parallels the impact of the telegraph in the Second Industrial Revolution. But the article does give some statistics on the latest rise of managers in the corporate world. Kelly?
So on top of all of the advancements in management and the technology to sort of plan, that sort of gives birth to this class of managers. and middle managers and middle managers. And despite the idea that we can make work more efficient and we can have fewer workers and produce the same amount, what we see is that there is a continuing increase to this day in the rise of corporate managers. And this goes back to the 1980s. So in the US, between 1983 and 2014, the number of managers, supervisors, and support staff in the US workforce grew by 90%, which is a pretty astonishing number, and that is not unique to the US. Similar trends can be found in the UK and other places. And I think what is really interesting is this new level, which I think we can all relate to and we can see in our organizations and other organizations, is this surge in the new C-level role. So this article specifically refers to a chief happiness officer, which of course makes me laugh, and my organization definitely does not have one of those. But we do have chief analytics officers, chief collaboration officers, chief customer officers, chief digital officers, and on and on and on. And I think that one thing that I was thinking a lot about it while reading about this really rapid increase in the number of managers is that it seems like, you know, when we talk about like building widgets better, we're talking about like a really clear sort of hierarchy in which like the widget maker reports to the floor manager who's overseeing 10 widget makers, who refers to the guy who sits upstairs. But I think more and more in businesses and organizations, we're starting to work across teams. So the widget team now has to talk to the design team, who now has to talk to the engineering team. And there seems to be a lot more management roles sort of at the nexus of those teams as we try to collaborate better across organizations. Of course, not all of these management positions are totally necessary, and many of them do introduce a degree of ineffectivity. And this article actually ends by referring to the fact that this rise in the number of managers is certainly, there's not a lot of evidence that it's a great thing or that it's the most efficient way to run an organization. But it is true that while private organizations sort of talk a big game about the inefficiency of government and the bureaucracy of government, they continue to have a larger and larger bureaucracy themselves.
I think that also like underscores again that question of who is benefiting from the way that we're doing planning and who is making the decisions, as opposed to whether or not we should have planning and whether or not we need to have bureaucracies. Those have been answered. That's really a settled question, whether people know it or not. It has been settled by the markets, so to speak, that it is necessary on some level. It's just a question of how much of it do you need, and who is making those decisions, and who is benefiting from those decisions. So we've obviously talked a lot on this show about the idea of worker-owned companies or, you know, syndicalist models of things where the trade union controls the company and that sort of thing, and makes those decisions. That would be an example where you would, if you had a completely worker democracy company, totally owned at every level and managed at every level by the, you know, by the workers themselves, and this is a theoretical exercise, we're not going to get into the specifics of how that would work or potential, you know, challenges with that. But in that model, you would then say like the managing decisions and the, you know, how many units per hour and how many breaks do you get and what are the labor conditions and what are our objectives with this project and things like that. Those decisions would all be undertaken by, say, the teams in that you just described, meeting with themselves and each other and taking a vote on what they wanted to do and so forth, blah, blah, blah. Now, again, you could criticize maybe that would have various planning challenges or inefficiencies of, you know, compared to somebody, you know, forcefully imposing their vision on the company from the top or something like that. But again, that gets into the question of who benefits. It gets into the question of, does that person know what they're doing? It gets into the question of, is the middle managing staff implementing that vision at all either? And so there are clearly drawbacks to the system that we have as well. There's no unique way that is somehow better or more effective. And I think most of us who are familiar with the corporate world or any entities that are structured in the way that it tends to be the default at this point would certainly question whether or not anything is being done in an efficient manner that makes any sense, often because when you add so many layers of management, you are divorcing yourself from the actual production modes and understanding what the conditions are at the bottom of the production process. Rachel, your final thoughts.
I just remembered, I think it was within the last year or so, we talked about the concept of BS jobs, David Graeber's book. And I think once you build this huge bureaucracy and these levels of management, the people at those levels are so alienated from the actual labor that is happening that it's just really demoralizing. So I think having that more democratically structured decision-making just gets rid of that alienation, that demoralization. So I think you wouldn't even need a chief happiness officer at that point, because everybody would be more invested, would be more valued and more heard, and that automatically translates to greater happiness. So I think trying to force happiness from the top down obviously doesn't work, as is evidenced by all the stereotypes of corporate America.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Kelly, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks, Bill.